It is remarkable that we've been living with these bombs for so long and no one has dropped another one, you know, in a conflict or been an accident. But the difficult thing about nuclear weapons is there's no guarantee that holds forever. You know, a lot of people have the idea that if I have nuclear weapons and you have nuclear weapons, we won't attack each other because we're afraid of retaliation. No one knows whether that is, you know, will be true for forever, and it seems unlikely that it will be.
That's Sarah Scholes. This is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Sarah Scholes on nuclear weapons and the future of the planet. The award-winning Oppenheimer film has brought attention to the origins of the atomic bomb and the anguish of its inventor. Almost 80 years after that first explosion in New Mexico, the threat of global Armageddon not only remains, but has increased. Until and unless nuclear weapons are abolished, humankind will always be in danger of massive death and destruction. Yet, instead of moving toward abolition, the U.S. is upgrading its arsenal. The doomsday clock is ticking. Sooner or later, intentionally or unintentionally, terminal war will destroy the planet. The only way to prevent that from happening is to eliminate all nuclear weapons. As long as they exist, humanity hangs by a thread. Our guest today is Sarah Scholes. She's an award-winning science journalist. Her articles appear in the New York Times, Wired, and the Scientific American. She's the author of Countdown, The Blinding Future of Nuclear Weapons. She spoke at the Boulder Bookstore in late February.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm hoping this talk won't fill you with too much existential dread, even though it's about like the world's most deadliest weapons. But we'll see. You can report back afterwards. Tell me what you think. Too much, too little. I was just going on a road trip somewhere. I don't know. I was probably doing some weird camping trip or something, and I was going to be driving through New Mexico. And I'm lucky enough to be a science reporter. And so I saw that Los Alamos National Lab and Sandia National Laboratories, they were on the way to where I was going. And these are both labs that are run by the Department of Energy and its National Nuclear Security Administration. And the Department of Energy is kind of cleverly named so that you don't fully realize that it's the agency in charge of maintaining our nuclear weapons. And so I saw these labs and I said, hey, can I stop by and just see what you guys are up to, talk to some of your scientists, learn about all this? And they said, sure, come on by. And I was like, oh, weird. Awesome. I will. But when I got there, what they talked to me about were not nuclear weapons. It was about like supernovae and nuclear power and solar panels and geology on Mars. Neutrinos, yeah. All kinds of interesting, cool science things, but not nuclear weapons. And in actuality, you know, their real mandate, and I think around 70% of their funding do go toward nuclear weapons. And so I was like, you know, what's up with that? Why aren't you talking to me about what it is you really do? And so I started trying to figure that out, starting with the scientists that I was talking to about black holes and supernovae and neutrinos and things like that. And it turned out that they were the same scientists who worked on nuclear weapons, because a supernova in space is essentially a nuclear bomb going off constantly very far away. And so eventually I tried to gain the trust of these scientists and eventually say, okay, now let's be real. Can we talk about nuclear weapons? Of course, nuclear weapons and their history began during the Manhattan Project, which... Who saw Oppenheimer? Almost everybody. So you probably got a little bit of an extra glimpse into the Manhattan Project, but it was this secret program to develop nuclear weapons without mostly any oversight or anyone knowing about it, even though around 100,000 people worked on the program, and most of them didn't really know exactly what they were working on. But there were labs and production sites across the United States, particularly in Washington State, Tennessee, and of course, our friend to the south, New Mexico. And in just 3 years, the Manhattan Project scientists were able to develop two different kinds of nuclear bombs, which they, of course, proceeded, well, they didn't. The United States proceeded to drop them on Japan near the end of World War II. And after that, we just kind of kept going. We kept building more bombs and more powerful bombs, and so did the Soviet Union after that, and then so eventually did other countries. And at the height of the Cold War, this is a crazy figure to me, but there were 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world, which is at least one too many. And today, we've decided that is a little excessive and cut it back to around 13,000, which is also a pretty high number. But the United States right now has more than 5,000 weapons in its possession, including ones that are retired but yet to be dismantled, which is also probably enough, right, to do whatever you would like to do with nuclear weapons. But there is a problem with them, at least according to some experts, which is that they are mostly decades old, some many decades old. And that has some people worried about whether nuclear weapons are what they say at these labs is safe, secure, and reliable. That is their tagline. And the analogy they use is, you know, you wouldn't buy a car in 1985, put it in your garage, turn it on in 2024, and expect it to act like it did in 1985 when you bought it. Or maybe you would. I don't know what you guys would do. But they're also worried about whether they will work as intended and be as effective as intended, where effective is like a euphemism for very deadly. Additionally, they're worried because other countries, particularly Russia and China, are also modernizing or expanding their set of nuclear weapons, and it's like a radioactive keeping up with the Joneses situation. And so we have this big modernization program that I was mentioning that is going to cost between $1 and $2 trillion, probably closer to $2 trillion over the course of 30 years, which is more than my allowance, I think. But this modernization program, in some cases, aims to just, you know, replace regular parts on weapons that might have degraded as time went on, like electronics and fuses. In other cases, it means adding new sensors that change how and when nuclear weapons would explode if they were going to explode. And also, we are designing the first new nuclear weapon that we have done since the Cold War, which is kind of wild to have not done it for so long and be doing it right now. And the biggest change, though, to me is a program called the Plutonium Pit Production Program. But a plutonium pit is basically a hollow sphere of plutonium metal that's in the middle of nuclear weapons that sets off the rest of the explosion. So these plutonium pits, they're plutonium metal, which kind of just looks like dull silver mixed with gallium, and they are at the center of nuclear weapons, and they're surrounded by regular explosives, kind of like fancy TNT, and that if you pressed go on a weapon, those explosives would detonate and push all that plutonium together, and that would start a critical fission reaction where the plutonium would start to split and perpetuate itself. And then that would, in turn, affect a second part of the weapon that is the more powerful part, the fusion part, and it would start to ignite this fusion reaction of pushing smaller atoms together to make larger atoms and releasing lots of energy in the process, where lots of energy, as with everything here, is a euphemism for like lots of really deadly, unpleasant stuff. The youngest pits we have right now were made in the late 1980s, and we used to make them at Rocky Flats, which I imagine a lot of people here are familiar with. Oh yeah, there's a picture of Rocky Flats. Has anybody been hiking in Rocky Flats? It's a hiking spot now. Yeah, it's a wildlife refuge now. I hear it has a herd of elk, but it used to be the site of the major place of plutonium pit production. And today we're going to be making 80 of these plutonium pits per year. But back then, they were making more than 1,000 pits per year. But the way you can do something like make 1,000 pits per year is by like not really obeying very many environmental regulations and things like that. So back in the late 1980s, the Rocky Flats production plant was raided by the FBI and the EPA for pretty big environmental violations that required a years-long cleanup, many, many, many monies toward that cleanup. Now the elk get to live there, and you can go hike there. I think it's very close to here. But obviously, when that happened, we stopped making them. We were like, we had enough. They did kind of a bad job. We can leave it alone. But now, you know, we're trying to replace them. There is no more Rocky Flats, and nobody wants to do it the way Rocky Flats did it because the elk have a place to live already. So they are spooling up plutonium pit production in Los Alamos and at a site in South Carolina called the Savannah River site. And they're hiring thousands of people to do this work, and they're going to work literally 24/7 on it as soon as they actually get started. As with everything in the government, it's behind schedule and over budget. But as you can imagine, anything involving plutonium is kind of a controversial program. And this is no exception. The arguments for making these new plutonium pits is that, you know, plutonium's point is that it's radioactive. It's constantly decaying, splitting out a smaller atom, particles, energy, and that creates impurities in the pit. And it also, like, the atoms knock each other around. And so the structure of it is different than it used to be. And, you know, maybe that means bad things for the pits in the future. And we don't know. There's no indications right now that there are any problems, but the proponents of pit production say before there are problems, we should try to revamp this infrastructure, be able to do this so that the nuclear weapons are still effective, there's not some kind of accident. And so as a very, very expensive insurance policy, we should get this thing going again. But there are also pretty solid arguments against this plan. The first one, I think, probably being what happened at Rocky Flats. No one wants that again. People are very reasonably afraid of environmental or maybe just personal contamination. Like, it's dangerous work for the people who are doing it. And the site in South Carolina where they will be making these, actually, it already has radioactive wildlife. It has radioactive roaches running around, allegedly. Radioactive alligators, and there's an annual deer hunt on site where before you're allowed to take your deer home, you have to get it scanned to see if you got a radioactive deer, which I don't know. You know, there's pros and cons to that, but you know, aside from that, there's the argument that if everything so far indicates that the plutonium pits are fine and there are no problems, why are you spending so much money doing such dangerous work to replace them? Maybe it's to keep these labs like Los Alamos and the site in Savannah River in business, and maybe it's to put them in new weapons, which is actually what we're doing first before replacing the old ones and old weapons. We're putting them in new weapons. I don't know. We could take a vote on what you guys think about plutonium pit production if you want, but it's hard for people like us to really, you know, figure out which side of it to be on because there's just not that much information out there. So lots of information relating to nuclear weapons, even stuff that might seem kind of innocuous, is what's called born classified, which means that, like, if I knew something about nuclear weapons and I wrote it down, it would be classified immediately, even if it was, I think, even if it was just me writing it down. Like, the stuff is just, it's just classified. And so you have to work to declassify it, which doesn't happen very often. And that information includes stuff you wouldn't expect. Like, I'm going to talk in a minute about a woman named Tess Light, and she helps look for nuclear detonations from space. So she has sensors on satellites, looks down, sees if anyone is exploding a nuclear weapon. And that happens because you can see, like, a burst of energy from it, obviously a large burst of energy. The sensors that she works on also pick up other stuff that is bursts of energy, particularly lightning. And she actually discovered this, like, cool phenomenon where there's this, like, very specific signature of lightning that happens right before a tornado, or not right before, before a tornado, where you can predict tornadoes earlier and with more accuracy than we can now. But she can't release that to anyone because it came from a nuclear sensor. So it's classified. Yeah, she says it's born classified, but it's lightning. And so I think people like her inside the nuclear infrastructure are just as frustrated as people on the outside. In the course of writing this book, I met a lot of very interesting people who work at the weapons labs. They kept their classified secrets, but they did tell me some information. So I can't tell you about too much about this lightning signature because it's born classified and I don't have access to that. But there is a lot of work that goes on at the labs that they can talk about, and not all of it has to do with building or designing nuclear weapons or stuff like that. A lot of the work they do is with a program called Stockpile Stewardship, which is a euphemism, like everything else. But it means we have this stockpile of nuclear weapons, and we can't test them anymore. Like, to find out if they work, we used to just blow them up. We used to take them out to Nevada or the Pacific Ocean and go press go and be like, did it work? Great. Does it not work? Okay, let's find out why. And now we can't do that. Rightfully, you know, it's not a great thing for political stability or like the atmosphere. Now we have to do small scale experiments and supercomputer simulations to try to figure out the kinds of things that we could just figure out by pressing detonate before. Someone told me it was like, you have a phone, you want to know if it turns on, works as expected. In a different world, in our world, you can just turn it on and find out. But in the world where you can't test it, you have to understand every capacitor, every resistor, all the parts of the circuit, and be able to model it in a computer and then say, I can tell you for sure that when this phone turns on, it'll work exactly as expected, which is pretty difficult. So there's a lot of people who work on that, and there's also people who work on things like non-proliferation and global security, which some people would say is the opposite of, you know, working on nuclear weapons, even though they coexist at the same lab. And so that's a long-winded way of saying these people work in global security and non-proliferation. And Teslite, like I said, she's the one with the classified lightning data. She started out as an astronomer, just studying stars. And then when she went off to like try to find a job, she thought, you know, stars are interesting. I love this physics, but I don't find it particularly personally satisfying to just be adding knowledge to the universe about the universe. And so she started looking around for other kinds of jobs and saw one at Los Alamos. She thought, you know, I like people. I don't want to blow them up. I don't want to work at a weapons lab. But she found the Global Security and Non-Proliferation Division, and they said, you know, you can take your expertise in stars and apply it to looking for the same kinds of radiation coming from the ground where someone is doing a nuclear test. So today she works on these sensors that fly on GPS satellites, which, you know, we think of as a way to get to the grocery store or to come to this bookstore. They also have a sensor that is constantly watching for whether anyone is blowing up a nuclear weapon, which is kind of wild. And she, you know, she took her astronomical expertise and applied it to Earth. And we need those kinds of programs for like enforcing the treaty that says we're not going to test nuclear weapons. So if you can, you have to be able to tell whether anyone is breaking it for it to be a meaningful agreement. That's what she does. And she teamed up with a guy named Josh Carmichael. And he also came from like a regular science background. He's a seismologist. And so he used to do things like go to Antarctica, put these sensors in the ice to see if the ice was shaking like an earthquake. But that was to measure like how it was changing with climate change and how it was moving and things like that. But you will be unsurprised to know that seismometers are also useful for detecting nuclear explosions, because when that happens, the ground shakes. And so he'd been working for a few years on a program to bring together different kinds of signals. So when a nuclear weapon goes off, the ground shakes. There's obviously radioactivity in the air. Radio waves come out of it. There's this thing called infrasound, which is like sound deeper, lower than sound. And you put all those things together and you can know that something is a nuclear weapon going off. And so he had been working on a computer program to kind of automate that. And then he teamed up with Teslite to combine her GPS signals with his on the ground signals and make it more automatic, which is pretty cool, because I couldn't believe when I found out that the way they do it now is like, you know, maybe you're a seismology expert and you're an expert in radio waves and you love infrasound. if we thought somebody had perhaps detonated a nuclear weapon and we saw some of those signals, I would like call you individually and ask you if you thought it was a nuclear weapon before we did. It's a very like manual, kind of tedious process that's not automatic. And so they're trying to make it more automatic, which is interesting to me at least. Then we have this guy, Chris Fryer. He's a computational physicist, which means that he's one of the people who kind of models the physics in a supercomputer, combining experiments that he does with digital simulations of things going on in the real world. And it is true what it says here, that he knows more about plasma than you, unless there's something about you that I don't know. But he founded this thing called the Center for Nonlinear Studies at Los Alamos. And a nonlinear thing is any kind of system like the climate or global health or something, where if you have a certain set of initial conditions, like the way things start out, and then you change it a tiny bit, the outcome you get is like wildly different. So that's like the weather. It's why the Colorado weather forecasts are always wrong. It's because they are nonlinear and there's a lot of variables going on. And so he founded this place to bring in young scientists who were studying nonlinear things that were not nuclear, like the weather or like this, you know, the spread of a pandemic or things like that. And then it's very clever what he does. He helps them make their methods of determining that better, and then takes their regular science and goes back to his classified hidey hole and applies it to the nuclear weapons work. That is actually the way that a lot of people end up working at nuclear weapons labs, is like getting recruited for the regular science that they're interested in and then saying, you know, here's this other classified weapons effort. We want you to get involved in that. And also we have more money and more resources than the science that you were doing before. But at the same time, the work that he's doing is advancing things like weather prediction and pandemic spread and other things like that. So the last person I'll tell you about, her name is Laura Berzac Hopkins. She might know more about plasma than Chris Fryer, but she's a plasma physicist. She works at a facility called the National Ignition Facility, which you might have heard about like a year ago. I guess you would have heard about it because it does fusion, and it's touted as a way to have fusion energy, which is kind of like the holy grail of the nuclear power sector. And they reached this point where they got more energy out of their fusion reaction than they put in. And but hopefully you know by now that it's not actually about fusion energy, it's about nuclear weapons. So the basics of it are that it is, I think, the world's most powerful laser. It's like 192 separate laser beams put together that all zoom in on this one piece of fusion fuel, energize it a lot, induce this fusion, and hopefully you get more energy out than you put in. And yeah, sure, that's like kind of useful for nuclear power, sort of, but like you're not going to build that in Boulder to like have fusion power. It's huge, it's expensive, it took a long time to build, it's like not the best way to go about it. So that's PR. But it's also useful for things like stars, like learning about how stars work or how supernovae work or things like that. But of course, it's also the same as what's going on in a nuclear weapon, or a way to, they put electronics that are inside nuclear weapons next to that reaction to see if a nuclear weapon can survive another nuclear weapon. So Hopkins gave me some interesting insight, which I imagine is somewhat controversial insight, which is that the basic science work that this does on things like stars is useful for weapons, even though it's not about weapons, because you can go publish a paper about a star, you can go write a press release about nuclear power, which you can't do really about the weapons work. And so you are kind of broadcasting to nuclear physicists the world over this information, like under the radar. If they see what you can do with a supernova, they know what you can do with a nuclear weapon, or they know what you know about nuclear weapons, but you don't have to tell them. You can just tell them about supernovae and then they can read into it. And so she's doing basic science as part of nuclear deterrence, which I thought was interesting. So it's kind of like science is the loud part, the weapons are the quiet part. I want nuclear weapons to be the loud part too. Not loud like when they go off, I hope that never happens, but just, I think we should talk about them more than we do, especially with this big modernization program going on. And because even when we don't think about it, like every international interaction includes them. When our country interacts with any other country, it knows, oh, that country has nuclear weapons, and that affects how things go. So I was going to read the come to Jesus moment that one of the scientists I talked to had while I was speaking to him. His name is Mark Paris, and he is a cosmologist, so he used to study the beginning of the universe and how things got started, and then he kind of got interested in nuclear weapons, and lucky for him, he worked at Los Alamos, so he could go research them, but he's conflicted about it. And Mark Paris still believes that understanding physics is important to a better nuclear future, although he's pretty uncertain about the nuclear present these days. Like everyone, he's worried a weapon might again, maybe soon, be used in anger. But if models of moving particles are hard to get right, if he cannot see their futures, that's even more true of the large mammals lording over this planet. The biggest mistake I see scientists making is to extrapolate their ability to predict in highly prescribed systems, he says. They tend to think they can generalize and take that to more complex systems like human relations. To me, it's folly and nonsensical to attempt that. Given that, he can't say how likely he thinks it is that someone will detonate a nuclear weapon, but he does believe he can predict something about what he himself will do in that case, at least if he survives, and so do his career choices. If that terrible eventuality should occur, agnostic the perpetrator, it will change my life, he says. I don't know exactly how, but I know it will. I will do something. I will certainly have to rethink working, he continues, at a place like this. He looks around at the tables full of coffee sippers, the highway full of cars that made it through the lab's gates, the buildings full of people imperfectly working out the futures of various things. I think that eventuality, which hopefully never occurs, calls into question the foundation of the existence of the lab's mission, he says. It's a somewhat faltering and circuitous statement, but it means that if a nuclear bomb goes off, deterrence has failed. Its philosophy, which is the philosophy of stockpile stewardship, has been proven false. In that case, keeping the weapons because they would keep the peace didn't, in fact, keep the peace. It only kept the weapons. That's what he thought. I think that can be the end of my talking, and well, thanks.
You're listening to Sarah Scholes on nuclear weapons and the future of the planet. This is Independent Alternative Radio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
The subtitle of your book is The Blinding Future of Nuclear Weapons. I'm curious about the word blinding.
I think that blinding, it kind of encapsulates a few aspects of nuclear weapons. Like, you know, if one ever went off again, it would be very blinding. It also speaks to the fact that, nuclear weapons are such a large part of our world society right now, even if we're not talking about them, that they can kind of fill the whole field of view and blind you to other things, for better or for worse. I don't think we know what the future holds for nuclear weapons, and so in some ways they blind us to themselves. Mm-hmm.
You say nuclear weapons are today as important as they were during the Cold War, and some experts say we could be as close to a nuclear catastrophe now as we were at the height of that conflict. Despite that, you write, conversations about nuclear bombs generally often happen in past tense. Why is that?
I think after the Cold War ended, everybody kind of got used to thinking about nuclear weapons less. You know, during the Cold War, they were on everyone's mind. There were air raid drills, you know, constant tension. And then once the Cold War ended, I think there was a feeling in and out of the nuclear establishment that we were going to become less dependent on them. And so our thinking about them just kind of went away, but they've always been there in the background. And, you know, the longer you have them, the more you have, the likelier there is to be an accident. And then also right now, you know, we have new and maybe more complicated conflicts involving nuclear states than we did during the Cold War.
Well, is there anything that could have been done at that time to have prevented what has occurred?
There are a number of good international agreements in place that do now, you know, limit at least the number of nuclear weapons that people have, although not everyone is a party to them. But I think if after the United States had made the first weapons, we all agreed, the world agreed, this is not something we want on the planet, then you could have had international agreements in that direction. Instead, I don't know how likely that would be given how humans are, but it's the kind of thing we've done for biological and chemical weapons, which people don't use theoretically. And so theoretically, you could have done the same for nuclear weapons before they had proliferated so much.
The first A-bomb test was in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. Its code name was Trinity. Interesting, using a word, you know, loaded with Christian theology. It was the culmination of the top secret Manhattan Project. J. Robert Oppenheimer, the lead scientist at the time, famously thought, "Now I have become death, the destroyer of worlds," a quote from Hindu scripture. He also said, "We knew the world would not be the same." Talk about an understatement. And it's been nothing short of a miracle, again, a kind of religious word, that either intentionally or unintentionally, we have not destroyed the planet.
Yeah, it is remarkable that we've been living with these bombs for so long and no one has dropped another one, you know, in a conflict or been an accident. But I think that the difficult thing about nuclear weapons is there's no guarantee that holds forever. You know, a lot of people have the idea that if I have nuclear weapons and you have nuclear weapons, we won't attack each other because we're afraid of retaliation. No one knows whether that is, you know, will be true for forever, and it seems unlikely that it will be.
Well, the deterrence doctrine was part of U.S. military strategy since the end of World War II. But it seems that Vladimir Putin in Ukraine flipped that on its head.
Yeah, it does seem that way. But, you know, because Ukraine did not have nuclear weapons and everyone else was afraid of Putin's nuclear weapons to some reasonable degree, it allows Russia more latitude, I think, than it would have had otherwise, especially since he has given implicit and pretty explicit nuclear threats. And so I think, you know, nobody wants to start World War III. And so I think that partly determines how other countries decide to intervene or not.
In the early days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Putin warned if anyone tried to intervene that, I'm quoting, "Russia will respond immediately and the consequences will be such as you have never seen in your entire history," unquote. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, that's very scary. And I think depending on who you ask, it's kind of an example of what experts call compellence, which is kind of the flip side, like you said, of deterrence, of compelling other nations to do what you want them to do using your nuclear weapons, kind of bullying them into getting what you want.
And speaking of Ukraine, there's a nuclear reactor at Zaporizhia that worried the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency. That threat seems to have gone down quite a bit. But what about accidents at these so-called peaceful reactors like Fukushima, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island?
Right. Yeah, I mean, anything with radioactive material something can go wrong with it or someone can attack it. And while it might not pose the same level of risk as a full-scale nuclear weapon with a critical reaction going on, it certainly is not good. And I think, you know, nuclear anything has a certain kind of taboo is quite the right word, but it's reasonably more scary than other, maybe more conventional things. And I think that holds whether it's a nuclear power plant being, you know, repurposed as a weapon or a weapon itself.
Well, talk about, you know, these safety concerns around reactors and the weapons systems themselves. For example, at the LANL, Los Alamos National Lab, the Cerro Grande fire in the year 2000 came very close to the buildings. There's apparently earthquake danger in Los Alamos. There was flood incidents and even a breach. So what about safety issues and the storage of radioactive waste and plutonium in underground locations?
Most, if not all, nuclear sites in the U.S., which is this largely the system that they call the national labs, which are in charge of maintaining the arsenal, have been around for a long time, including times when there were many fewer environmental regulations than there are now. And so they have a large amount of leftover contamination and, you know, probably some newer contamination that they have created. And so things like the Cerro Grande fire that you mentioned was encroaching on land that, you know, contained at least legacy radioactive contamination that could have been, you know, thrust up into the air during the wildfire. And that is scary. And I mean, I think whether you're working with radioactive material, you have leftover contamination, or you're storing waste, like no matter what it is, there is always some amount of risk to human health and the environment.
And in multiple ways, it seems, you know, New Mexico is ground zero for a lot of this, particularly I'm thinking of the Carlsbad Cavern, where radioactive waste has been stored supposedly safely.
Mm-hmm. They have that storage facility. There's a national lab called Sandia outside of Albuquerque and then Los Alamos. So, but they have had a large accident there. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but I believe it was 2014, there was some waste from Los Alamos that was stored improperly. It was supposed to be stored with a certain kind of kitty litter to kind of neutralize it, and it was stored with a different kind, and it essentially became a dirty bomb underground that released contamination and shut the site down for multiple years.
The Los Alamos National Laboratory, LANL, in New Mexico is about 30 miles from Santa Fe. And that's where, in the 1940s, Oppenheimer and his crew of scientists worked on the bomb, the Manhattan Project. The lab's stated mission is, I'm quoting, to solve national security challenges through simultaneous excellence. I had a little trouble understanding the words there. Can you help me out?
If I had to hazard a guess, I would guess that they mean excellence across all of the disciplines that they work in. So, you know, all the different kinds of physics and engineering all has to come together inside a nuclear weapon to make it what they like to say there is safe, secure, and reliable.
Talk about the people that you talk to there. You say they like to discuss, I'm quoting, easily palatable, press releasable science. What's the PR around LANL and the system in general? And given their spin, how are you able to carry out your investigations?
Yeah, I believe the latest figure is that 70% of LANL's budget goes to nuclear weapons, but most of the things they talk or write about in public are about basic science, like, you know, climate change or how pandemics spread or how to do work on Mars or the, you know, how does a supernova work? And those are often the things that do make it into the press releases, in part because it's not the kind of stuff that makes people mad, and also because it's not classified. And so you can talk about it. And, you know, I wrote a thing or two about that and met some interesting scientists. And I could tell that underneath that research that they were doing on those sciences, it had some applicability to weapons. And so I said, you know, we've talked about your supernova. I want to talk about what you do for weapons now. And, you know, they did things like check my background a lot and make me. But eventually they agreed to give me access to the facility and to the scientists.
Talk about modernization of the whole range of weapons. Why has the U.S. undertaken the largest and most expensive ever modernization program? And I presume it's a bipartisan affair among our political rulers that will cost tons of money. Any price tag numbers yet?
The price tag numbers are always in flux, but I think it's safe to say between $1 and $2 trillion over about 30 years. And yes, it is bipartisan. It has gone through multiple administrations' policies on nuclear weapons. And so modernization involves taking weapons that we built, you know, mostly decades, in some cases many decades ago, and sometimes upgrading really sort of basic components like, you know, electronics or fuses or things like that. In some cases, changing out the regular explosives that are inside nuclear weapons to ones that are less sensitive to things like dropping or fire or things like that. In other cases, it means, you know, right now we're designing the first new nuclear weapon that we have designed in decades. We haven't added any new weapons to the arsenal in a long time. And we are also creating these things called plutonium pits. And these are spheres of plutonium that are at the center of modern nuclear weapons. And they kind of set off the larger bomb. They're surrounded by conventional explosives. Those explosives go off, squish the plutonium, and start the critical reaction that then ignites fusion. And so we're making more of those. And let's see, you asked about the motivation for it. So the part of the motivation is, you know, you wouldn't buy a car in 1980, never take it out of the garage, and expect it to drive the way that it did when you bought it, which, you know, makes it all sound very reasonable that you would want to replace some parts to ensure that the weapons are safe and not going to do something we don't expect. But also from the defense side, you know, they want to make sure that they work the way they are expected to and are as efficient and effective as they're expected to be if they're used, which is also, you know, disturbing to think about them being used. But across the world, other countries are, you know, either working on acquiring more nuclear weapons, like China is increasing its arsenal and Russia is modernizing its arsenal. And so the idea is that you want to be able to match what other countries are doing. On the other side, people might say, you know, it's good business for the labs. It's a big project and it's internationally provocative to starting the arms race all over instead of decreasing dependence.
In your Scientific American article, you have a remarkable photograph here that I'd like you to tell our listeners about.
Let's see.
It's not too far from where we're sitting here.
Right.
We're in Boulder, Colorado, and that photograph is...
It's at F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. So if we just drive a few hours north, we would be right there. And it's a picture of three intercontinental ballistic missiles standing next to each other, decreasing in size. The Peacekeeper, the Minuteman III, and the Minuteman I, and they are just hanging out in Wyoming.
George Orwell would have loved that Peacekeeper.
The Peacekeeper, yes.
2025 will mark 80 years since we entered the so-called, what is called the nuclear age. Nine countries possess nuclear weapons, the U.S., Russia, France, China, and the United Kingdom, essentially the entire Security Council at the U.N. And then there's Pakistan, India, Israel, and North Korea. And I should add that Israel has never admitted it has nukes. That seems to be an off-limits subject for the media and Washington politicians. In total, the global nuclear stockpile is close to 13,000 weapons. Do you think that's enough?
I think that's plenty, yeah.
Why so many?
It is, you know, I think the highest number of nuclear weapons that's been on the planet is 70,000, which is kind of incredible to think about. But I think it comes from every country that has nuclear weapons just wanting to feel like they can match or best everybody else. And, you know, that is an arms race that increases the number until you have some kind of agreement like, okay, we're going to stop making more. But I mean, you're right. We definitely have enough to get whatever job done that we want to have done, which hopefully is not a job we ever want to do.
And I should add that, you know, countries like South Korea and Saudi Arabia seem to be very interested in acquiring these weapons of mass destruction. And hardly a day goes by when there isn't some word linking Iran to the development of weapons. But there is this constant danger of proliferation. You know, we saw that with AQ Khan of Pakistan, who worked with North Korea in developing their weapons. So the knowledge is proliferating and more states will climb on board the bandwagon.
It's essentially 80-year-old science that people don't need to have access to classified information, really, to be able to design and build a nuclear weapon, having the infrastructure to actually do it. That's the actual hard part. And having your own nuclear weapons is a more attractive prospect to a lot of, maybe not a lot of countries, to some countries than it has been in the past, when maybe non-proliferation was more on the table. Because with countries invading other countries in a ground war sort of way that hasn't exactly happened on the scale that we're seeing it recently, Like, if Ukraine had nuclear weapons, would Russia have done what it did? And I think, you know, a lot of people say the answer is no. And so from that perspective, everybody wants their own, because then you can stop that kind of thing, theoretically. But then that's how you end up back in a world with 70,000 nuclear weapons.
You say that secrecy has always been a big part of the story, for obvious reasons, but explain why.
From the beginning, starting with the Manhattan Project, which was meant to be a very secret project, I think it is, in fact, a little less secret than we talk about it now. But the idea is that at that time, people can't know we're working on this weapon so that we can beat them to making one. And ever since then, it has also been about, you know, beating other countries in some way, or having the best in a way that they don't have. And so atomic information is some of the most highly protected information in the government. The Atomic Energy Act classifies all nuclear weapons relevant information of a certain sort as born classified. So if you write something down about a nuclear weapon, you don't have to classify it. It's classified just by existing. And so that has been true since the 1950s, which is kind of wild, but does make it hard for, you know, you and me and everybody listening right now to know things like the details of the modernization program or what is going on, just because so many of those details remain classified.
With rapidly developing AI, is there a danger there?
There is kind of hypothetical talk about turning over some of the nuclear decision-making process over to AI, whether that's analyzing the data that indicates whether someone else has launched nuclear weapons, or, you know, on the extreme end, letting an AI make the decision about whether to launch a nuclear weapon. I think fundamentally the defense apparatus is kind of conservative with the technology it adopts. And so I think it'll be at least a while before we see that. But where AI is already showing up is in a program called Stockpile Stewardship, which is taking the nuclear weapons that we do have, you know, whose age we are worried about, and trying to understand what's going on inside those aging weapons. And that involves a lot of supercomputer simulation and right now kind of investigating how AI could play a role in understanding that sort of physics.
Reagan and Gorbachev said, quoting, "A nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought." That was in 1985. 6 years later, the Soviet Union collapsed. Was there a space then for eliminating weapons of mass destruction? There was some talk of a peace dividend at that time, you may recall, which never really materialized.
Mm-hmm.
There was some reduction in weapons,
mm-hmm.
but not substantial.
It's hard to say, and hindsight is always 20/20, that maybe that was a good moment to have done that. But I mean, that's a pretty remarkable statement that they would get together and say that, these two countries in conflict.
And particularly with Reagan, with his reputation of being a hawk.
Right, yes. But I mean, I think most people would agree that they're right. Nobody wins in a nuclear war, and in an ideal world, we would never have one. Treaties have come along, like the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which kind of commits the countries who have signed it either to not acquire nuclear weapons if they don't have them, or to decrease their dependence on them with the idea of eventually eliminating them. We also have the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty that means that we don't blow up weapons just to test them. And so there was a lot of this stuff in the air that would have indicated that, you know, we could have moved more in that direction than we have. And it seems like we're moving in the opposite direction.
And that test ban treaty was for atmospheric detonations, right?
Atmospheric, the one in the 1990s was also for underground testing, no more testing. There was an earlier one for atmospheric testing.
Well, here's an enigma. I mean, if you can't win a nuclear war, as Gorbachev and Reagan say, and everyone agrees with them, why have the weapons? Why take the risk?
Yeah, you know, it is hard from an international dynamics perspective to get anyone to agree to get rid of nuclear weapons if other countries are not, and getting everyone to agree to do it in the same way at the same time is no easy feat. And so I think the philosophy that at least the U.S. has come to is that having nuclear weapons prevents nuclear war, which is kind of contradictory. But if you have nuclear weapons, they're so bad that they can't ever be used, and so no one would initiate someone else's use, and so nuclear war won't happen because we have this deterrence going on. But as a scientist named Brad Roberts, who works at Lawrence Livermore, told me, as long as deterrence is unstable and unpredictable, which he agreed that it was, we should move toward disarmament, getting rid of the weapons. And as long as disarmament isn't happening tomorrow, we need deterrence to keep the peace. And I think that within the national labs and the defense apparatus, that would be what they would say.
To keep the peace, their war is breaking out.
Right. I know. Just the past few years have really tested that idea of nuclear deterrence, what it's worth, and how it's working in the real world.
Since you wrote Countdown, what new developments have occurred that we should know about?
This plutonium pit production that we were talking about earlier is moving forward. Both the lab at Los Alamos and the Savannah River site in South Carolina are in the process of hiring thousands of people who are going to work literally 24/7 to be building these 80 plutonium pits a year. And to me, I think that's the biggest thing that has been going forward, just because it's such a large part of the ongoing program and something we haven't done since 1989.
Tell me more about the scientists that you talk to at Los Alamos and elsewhere. How do they go about justifying what they're doing? I mean, producing weapons of mass destruction that can end life on Earth as we know it.
I think for the most part, you know, everyone makes sense of their job and what they're adding to the world. And so they have made sense of their job and what they're adding to the world through this idea of deterrence in some ways, that, you know, they believe they're working on a system that does keep the peace. And, you know, we could all agree with that or not. But in some cases, they see themselves as being part of creating world stability. On the other hand, the other scientists also at the labs say what you just said, which is that actually the world is not very stable, and this is not a trustworthy or reliable idea, and we shouldn't hold ourselves at constant nuclear peril. However, I think they all agree that nuclear weapons exist. The United States is unlikely to get rid of theirs tomorrow. And so while they exist, someone needs to be kind of overseeing them and keeping them up and making sure, you know, they are not dangerous of course they're dangerous, but making sure they're safe, secure, and reliable. And so that is the other attitude. But there's also a lot of scientists who work at the national labs who do work in nonproliferation, in trying to scale back or at least keep steady the number of nuclear weapons in the world and making sure no one is testing them or blowing them up. And so it's kind of this two-headed thing of people who work on weapons at the same labs as people who work on making sure that there are as few weapons as possible.
Well, of course, I have to ask you about the award-winning movie Oppenheimer.
Of course.
Your critique of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think Oppenheimer as a whole was fundamentally good at introducing people to maybe some of the issues around nuclear weapons and some of the existential questions like, you know, what does it mean to work on them, and what does it mean to decide to use them, and how does that weigh on the people who are part of that, and you know, how did the Manhattan Project work? And I think, you know, a lot of people probably hadn't thought about that in a deep way in a while, and so it made it more popular. On the other hand, the things that the movie doesn't show are things like how people were affected by the test and then ultimately, you know, died in Japan because of the weapons that were dropped. It was a focus mostly on this guy who was working on the programs and not on how the programs affected people.
And his peculiar angst. He was clearly a conflicted character, because here he was creating something, which is very exciting for anyone, a scientist in particular, inventing the bomb, but then ultimately losing control over his invention and losing government security clearance.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think there's a historian I talked to for the book named Audra Wolf, who says that since the Manhattan Project, physicists have gotten better at thinking through the implications of their work because of things like the Manhattan Project, but they still haven't quite taken the lesson that they don't really have any political power over what happens to their research after it's done, which Robert Oppenheimer also had to learn. Like, you lose control of the creation. A lot of scientists still think they might have some more control over the creation than they do.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Sarah Scholes on nuclear weapons and the future of the planet. I talked with her in late February in Boulder, Colorado. Sarah Scholes is an award-winning science journalist and author of Countdown, The Blinding Future of Nuclear Weapons. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, Ralph Nader, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Boulder Bookstore and KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.